This is CliffCentral.com.
What a song. Power. That'll get you through your Wednesday morning.
And they wrote it themselves.
There ain't nothing wrong with being a great performer, but not a songwriter.
Imagine being four great performers and songwriters at the same time.
That's amazing. So it's James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich, and who else? Who are the other two?
In this particular incarnation, it was Jason Newsted on bass and obviously Kirk Hammett on guitar. At the Rob Trujillo, for the last 14 years, has been the bass player of Metallica, right. But at that point, Jason Newsted.
Wow, what a band. All right, and they still sound good.
Their new album
They have aged really well.
They had a bit of a down patch around the 2003 to 2008 sort of period, after having a bit of a rough time within the band and making a truly cuck album, Insane Anger. But since then, they've de-aged. What happens when you just like get younger as you go along? I've seen them live 7 times and they've improved.
They're Benjamin Buttoned,
exactly that. And their new album, which came out in December, is a masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. And live, they just still spank bands half their age, even less than half their age these days.
Who's this guy?
That's James Hetfield.
I'm down with him.
Yeah, Lord and Savior.
Down with him.
All right, there are a couple of messages that came through on the various screens this morning, WeChat, WhatsApp, and Twitter. Let me get to one or two of those quickly. I must say, says Jared, the UK's Olympic buildings are at least in use, and the government decided to build the biggest mall in Europe right next to the village, even though it's mostly council housing. There's some comments on what Ben brought up about the Brazilian Olympic problem with the accommodation they built. Rusty says that the new season of Game of Thrones opened with a bang. It's simply the best thing ever. Simply amazing. Well, that excites me because I haven't seen it yet. And Gloria Mary Mulima says, morning team, I trust that you're all well. I'm a proud podcaster who's listening live today. Where is Duncan Mabasso? Duncan's actually working for our old sales manager, Neil. And the two of them have opened up an office here in Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm. Duncan has been gone for a while.
Yeah. So I heard.
Hang on. Mary hasn't finished. She says, please ask Ben, why does the man in the green t-shirt have his pair of ears on the same side? Did he Photoshop it? I saw it in his Twitter page. What's that all about, Ben?
I took a panoramic of the cricket. I used that as my Twitter.
Those panoramics, sometimes.
And then the guy just ended up with two ears. And I left it because I thought it was funny.
I took a panoramic at a family function once.
Yeah.
And I could never use the picture because one of the aunts looked like a monster. Because if you take a panoramic and you just slowly move, then what it does is it sort of gels together different parts and it tries to make a... And she was obviously turning her head at the time, so she looks frightening.
But like, you are really supposed scary. You're supposed to jaw things. Ben just showed me the dude with two ears. That's awesome. You're supposed to jaw things that are like moving less.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
Like sunsets.
Yeah, yeah. It's
mountains.
Meant to be landscapes, not people.
Quite work
not
with like, people, yeah.
Yeah, not a rave. If you panoramic a rave, you're going to find people with melted body parts. And
all right, and Glory also says, peace and love, peace and love. Very important.
So on Duncan... I heard that he has started a podcast series.
Oh, really?
And it's called Jazz on My Face.
Oh, no!
Oh, that's great.
No!
It's just...
You know, I sometimes feel like we made a mistake by introducing podcasting to South Africa. I really feel maybe we should have just left it where it was.
That was always Duncan's dream.
No, really.
Jazz on My Face was always his dream.
I think that is a classic title. Classic.
Yeah, he did want to do it. All right. It's time to check in on some news.
Yes. All right. So our police minister, Fikile Mbalula, was addressing journalists during a visit to the Sunnyside Police Station in Pretoria. This is where he did his annual Mandela Day service. And, you know, he said that he had directed his deputy, Bongani Mkongi, to correct his recent remarks regarding the prevalence of crime and foreign nationals in Johannesburg. The minister saying, I've gone through what he said, and indeed that is too rough.
Okay, well, hang on. So first of all, remember, Fikile is actually the Minister of Police.
Yeah.
Which is, for some people, a frightening thing. It means that he's responsible for safety and security in this country. However... mostly, he hasn't said as many dumb things as he used to say as Minister of Sport. I mean, Ben, is that a fair comment to make?
Sure. Yeah.
Less dumb stuff.
Yeah, let's go for it. Yeah. Pretty right. much less attention, that's why.
Now, his deputy held a press conference yesterday, and he said some things about foreign nationals. Do you want to hear that clip?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find that for you, because this is where the controversy comes from. What is his name again?
Bongani Mkongi.
Bongani Mkongi. I'm just looking it up. About foreign nationals. I'm just trying to look up the clip quickly. Here we go. Got it. It's from EWN, right? Okay. There he is, talking about this problem. And he says that 80% of Johannesburg is foreign nationals.
That's what he says.
He means places like Hillbrow, obviously. He means, you know, parts of the Joburg CBD that have been taken over by these foreign nationals.
And townships, you can hear, as well.
The question arises. And we must investigate also what is the law of South Africa says. How can a city in South Africa be 80% foreign nationals? That is dangerous. That in Hillbrow and the surrounding areas, South Africans have surrendered.
He really makes effective use of the pregnant pause.
Yes, yeah.
With triplets, that pause had.
Their own city. To the foreign nationals. The nation should discuss that particular question. You won't find South Africans in other countries dominating a city.
Well, have you ever been to South London? There are parts of Putney that I would ever are more South African than English.
Yeah, they hang the flags in the windows. You can't miss it. You commute and there's like literally South African flags every third window. It's pretty cool, actually.
Into 80%. Because if we do not debate that, that necessarily means the whole South Africa could be 80% dominated by foreign nationals. And the future president of South Africa could be a foreign national.
So I have to ask, because he said we must debate this. What would be so wrong with that? Like, what makes you feel that because of the artificial borders that were drawn by our colonial ancestors and masters that makes South Africa a country? What about those borders makes you so special that you can be president, but someone from Zimbabwe who speaks a very similar language and might just have lived on the other side of the fence and crossed right back here can't be president? Why do you think it's so special to be South African, Mr. Deputy Police Minister?
Well, I mean, isn't this the same problem that Barack Obama faced when he became president? Is some people wanted him to produce his birth certificate because they were like, oh, hang on. I mean, are you even really American?
But what?
So, like, you know, people have this
some
problem
people,
of...
mainly Trump, yeah.
All right, so hang on. If our city of Johannesburg, parts of it, are 80% foreign nationals, didn't they come in there because they saw opportunity where we didn't? Didn't they come in because they could sustain a livelihood there that we couldn't? Didn't they prove in doing so that they deserve to be there more than all of us do? And didn't they also take that place, not by force, but by force of will, by desire to improve their own lives? I think it's a statement of their superiority over us. And we should be celebrating immigration of that kind that adds value to the economy, even if, as he says later in the clip, it involves drug dealing and prostitution, which, by the way, you can't prove is just the foreign nationals.
Well, it's not just the foreign nationals. The deputy minister conveniently forgot the part about how in certain parts of the country, said foreign nationals have SAPS officials on their payroll, and they have police officers taking bribes from them, and they have police officers providing them with weapons. He conveniently forgot that part. And those police officers are not foreign nationals. They're South African.
And he sounds paranoid because listen to how he carries on. We can get into some of the detail of this. We've got some time. Listen to this. I'd like to hear your thoughts as well.
We're surrendering our land. And it is not xenophobia to talk truth. We fought for this land.
I mean, he must be 17. He doesn't look like he fought for anything. And if you're going to unroll and unravel history, then there are a lot of people who fought for this land. And not one of them deserves it more than any other.
And a lot of people in a lot of other countries in Africa that also fought for this land in solidarity with the people fighting for this
land. Yeah, but if you want to have this argument, if you want to talk about conquering the land or fighting for the land, then you have to acknowledge that Jan van Riebeek and those people fought for their little piece of the land too. So then you have to acknowledge that they deserve their part of it, which I don't think he wants to do. You can't do this with history. You can't look at what you've got and claim it as being special and then not apply the same rules retrospectively to other people. The Zulus fought the British at Sandlwana and beat them. The British then beat them, or I think it was the other way around, but at Rorke's Drift. Both fought for the land. Both have a claim on the land. Mm. Neither is superior or inferior.
And various groups had been fighting for the land, winning and losing
that,
prior.
Before that, Shaka had chased almost everyone who he didn't like out of KZN. So he fought for that land. Does that mean all those people who were chased out don't deserve to have a claim on the land? And all these people who migrated south from other parts of Africa because of economic opportunity here, they might not be fighting for the land, which you should be grateful for, police minister, because your police force wouldn't be able to stop them if they did. How can they not also have a claim on the land? And what does it mean to be a stupid citizen anyway? Like, what's so great about being a South African? What makes you think you're so special and interesting? Because you claim that you fought for the land. Lots of people fought for the land.
I think there's a distinction to draw, though. Like, I'm super proud to be a South African, but I don't think it makes me better than everybody else.
Well, that's where the problem comes in, is when South Africans develop a superiority complex when it comes to other countries on this continent. A lot of South Africans are walking around generally thinking that they are the best on this continent.
Well, we're clearly not. I would aver that almost everybody else who comes here does a better job of whatever we're doing than we do. And so much of that can be proven in places like Hillbrow. Who's running the spaza shops? Who's running the apartment blocks, whether they're invaded or not? Who's running the place? Is it us? No.
And what advantage did they start with when they arrived?
Nothing. Nothing. So ask yourself, really, if you think we're superior.
It's going to be an emotive one, this. I can see some fairly fiery tweets coming in.
No, it's always been an emotive one. I mean, you know, on the issue of crime, because I find that it is very difficult for a lot of people to talk about foreign nationals without very quickly linking them to crime. And I think that this is a dangerous thing to do, because the perception or the message that you're sending out is that foreign nationals are prone to coming into the country and breaking the law and committing crime. Mm. Now, where are the facts for that? Where are the facts for that when, for example, when women are outraged about femicide and the statistics around rape in this country, and when the stats tell us that these crimes are being committed by men we know, our uncles, our brothers, our fathers, our boyfriends, our husbands? None of these men are foreign nationals. They're all South African men. What facts are you using to back up these arguments, these messages that you're sending out, when you're trying to create the impression that foreign nationals come into this country to commit crime?
How about the fact that about 50 Gauteng police who have been accused of killing people in various protest marches and all the rest of it have never been charged, brought before a court? Nothing's happened. This is the deputy police minister. Clean up your own garden before you start worrying about foreign nationals. Your own garden is the police force, which in this country is a disgrace. I feel very sorry for hardworking policemen and women, and there are some. There are people who go out there and they risk their life every day to protect you and me. Mm. This guy is in charge of them, and he's worrying about foreign nationals when what he really should be doing is making sure the police force is clean. Clean up what's going on in the police. As Mabali said, there are police people on the payrolls of various criminals. We know who they are. We know where they live. We know what they're doing. Tidy that up.
And in terms of foreign nationals coming here only to do crime, I mean, especially if you've spent time in or lived in or live in Cape Town, man, the will to work. You get these dudes, and the thing that drives me completely insane is the people in the traffic that hoot at them and swear at them. You get these guys, they pack up their whole little store into like this little, I don't know how to explain it, but it's a very large, very, very large shopping cart type of box on wheels. They pack in an entire store into there. There's a couple of places throughout town where they can lock them away for the night. They get them at like, you know, sparrow fart in the morning. They pull them with ropes down the roads, up the roads to their various locations, kilometers of pulling a heavy thing, and then at 6-7 p.m. they pull them back after working the whole day. I mean, it is brutally hectic, and usually there's two or three of them to a cart, and they push them up the road, and then yeah, the motorists hoot and freak out and stress because they have to overtake them. And it's like that level of hard work, hustling making it happen. It's like, I just think to myself, anyone who hoots at a person working that hard at an honest job can seriously drive into the nearest wall.
I'm a white minority. We cannot surrender it to the foreign nationals. That is a matter of principles. We fought for this country, not only for us, for the generations of South Africans. The arms that are being used here in Hillbrow are arms of war, which are unlicensed. The hijacking of buildings here in Hillbrow is a sign of taking over power. The question of dominance of foreign nationals in illegal trading and also businesses that are here in Hillbrow is an economic sabotage that is taking place against our people.
Economic sabotage. Some of these people are the only ones adding value to the economy in these places.
But I mean, you also have to look at both sides of the coin, like things like building takeovers and that kind of stuff.
Sure,
there are some seriously bad problems that nationals might be at the heart of, but that's not to say...
But then the police's responsibility is to clean them up, so don't blame it on them.
Exactly.
Why aren't you enforcing the law? You believe in property law, deputy police minister? Then enforce it. It's your... Don't stand... How dare you sit there in a press conference and tell us what's wrong... that you are responsible for fixing, as if it's someone else's fault. In this case, you're blaming the foreign nationals.
There's lots of crime, and it's due to the specific people who are committing it, not due to the fact that the police aren't stopping it.
Yeah, and don't for a minute say to me that all the foreign nationals are the ones who are committing these crimes. There may be a small group of them. There may even be a group of South Africans who are complicit in this too. But don't try and blame all foreign nationals. It seems like scapegoating. This is what the Nazis said about Jews back in the 1930s. Roman, what's up?
Yeah, morning, Gareth. How's everyone today?
Very well. The Renegade Report is on every Tuesday. You had a new episode released just yesterday.
Indeed, with a Muslim reformer, a lady from California who grew up in Pakistan, who is a Sufi Muslim and argues that Islam as we know today is not the same as the one in the Quran.
All right.
So, if they want to listen, it's available. But just talking about these foreigners, the Institute of Race Relations released a report in March this year. And it's stark reading. Do you know that over 80% of spaza shops in the whole country are owned by foreigners?
I didn't know that. What do you think the reason for that is?
Well, they work together. There's a study that shows that an average foreigner comes in with about 1,500 rand. Mm-hmm. Within 18 months, turns that into 50,000 rand through trade. And as for the issue of crime, it's very difficult to do anything without an ID number. And Home Affairs is notoriously xenophobic. So what do people do? They do crime, but crime in the sense of they deal in illegal cigarettes, or they sell prostitution or sex work or drugs, but these are not meant to be crimes anyway. I mean, come on, it's we live in a society where you know, selling your body for sex is a crime. So if you call that a crime, obviously you are incorrect.
Yeah, and also it seems to me that this is just a way, it's really just plain old scapegoating, which is what I referred to a moment ago, trying to find someone else to blame for your own incompetence as a minister.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the thing with foreigners generally around the world, they work harder than local people. If you look at Pakistanis in in the UK, if you look at Koreans in the US, if you look at Zimbabweans in this country, mm-hmm. there is no safety net. There is nothing. So they have to put in the time, they have to put in the work, they have to get the networks up and running, and they can't rely on the state to bail them out. So of course they work harder. It's not because South Africans are inferior, it's because foreigners have no alternative.
Yeah, it's very simple. A lot of them come from a dire situation back at home, and they really come here with no other option but to succeed. That's the only option that they have. Make it work.
And as Roman says, in South Africa, we've got a safety net for our own people, which takes the form of welfare, which we know is an unsustainable situation in every way. 17 million people who are reliant on that. And of course, if you have to compete with a desperate, hardworking, has-to-succeed foreigner, and they're very... ambitious and motivated reason to make it, and you could rather sit on your backside and take a grant. Not that I'm saying that that's what all people who do take grants do. Guess which one you're going to choose.
But something even more pernicious: the ANC government supports the dictators and the tyrants in those countries from where immigrants flee from to South Africa. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. Make a decision.
Yeah, if you're going to be anti, if you're going to do something to help these people and to stop them from coming into our country and make their own conditions back home a little more livable, then stand up against those tyrants. Otherwise, don't complain when they come here. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. It seems so simple, but somehow simplicity is never a good thing in politics.
Tell me quickly, since you're on the line, what would you imagine the situation would be if the ANC completely ruined South Africa, which they seem hell-bent in some cases of doing, and our people, all of us, had to leave and go and live in other African countries? What kind of reception do you think we would receive?
I think it will be similar to what the Jews received in the 30s. You'll just have boats of South Africans floating around the Indian Ocean, being unable to land in any African country, because we treated their people badly when they arrived in South Africa, so why do they need to take us?
Yeah, you could already see this in the AU. Just recently, they had very vociferous debates at the AU, which is otherwise a very effete, incompetent eunuch of an organization. They did bring up the fact that they think South Africans have got an attitude problem. That's why they didn't like Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma.
Yeah, I mean, I'm friends with a lot of French-speaking Africans from Senegal and Ivory Coast and all that. They refuse to integrate at all because they say they don't feel welcome. People look down upon them. So what they do is actually they create their own community. They all live in Yeovil. Every single 80% of the people in Yeovil are French African, mm-hmm. and they've got their own stores. They've got their own security. They live completely free from the state. And they have actually quite a nice livable area.
In other words, again, the state is the opposite of the solution.
Well, of course, in almost every single problem, the state is not the answer.
All right, thanks, Roman.
In almost every single problem, the state is not the answer.
Right. I mean, seriously, just open up all the borders in Africa, for God's sake. They're colonial borders. Let's decolonize Africa. Take away all the borders, let people settle wherever they want to, and let's have a proper...
That would be a real AU.
Well, yeah,
one would think. And we'd create the biggest trading block in the world.
One would think.
Well, at least a sizable one. Yeah. All right, man, thanks.
All right.
Thanks, Roman.
All the best. Cheers, guys.
Don't miss the Renegade Report Tuesdays on cliffcentral.com. It's one of our best podcasts, according to you, because the numbers are... growing on that one. So if you like what Roman just said, now you got to listen to what they talk about, him and Jonathan Witt. On Tuesdays, they release the podcast, but you can go and listen to any of the previous episodes by heading over to cliffcentral.com. If you haven't downloaded the app, do that ASAP too. All right, what else do we have time for with the news?
Okay, well, I guess we could talk about how Madonna is seeking to stop a New York auction of selling a letter that she wrote to Tupac Shakur.
Oh,
what? Yep. Oh. This happened yesterday when Madonna attempted to stop an upcoming auction of a prison breakup letter from the rapper. Sorry, it was from the rapper. Mm-hmm. And a note in which she also apparently called the singer Whitney Houston and actress Sharon Stone horribly mediocre. Oof, Madonna.
Madonna, serious. You bitch.
So, she filed a request in New York Supreme Court for a temporary restraining order against Gotta Have It Collectibles. They're an auction house. Madonna said in court documents that she was not aware until reading press reports that many of the items that are listed for this auction include a letter from her former boyfriend, Tupac, which is no longer in her possession.
I forgot that she dated Tupac.
Yeah, she was in there. The items were consigned to auction by a woman called Darlene Lutz, whom Madonna described as a friend who was also an art consultant, and said that she had felt betrayed by Darlene because allegedly this letter that Tupac had sent her was in Darlene's possession, and now Darlene has made it, you know, available for auction, I suppose. Now, a representative for the auction house, as well as Darlene, said in an emailed statement that Madonna's effort to stop the sale was a completely baseless and meritless action, and they would challenge her claims in court.
Just in case I misunderstand, is Darlene actually the auction company lady?
Darlene is...
Because if you loan your breakup letter to someone who owns an auction company of celebrity memorabilia and then feel betrayed that their celebrity memorabilia auction it...
Darlene is an art consultant, and Madonna said that she considered her a friend for a while. It is not exactly specific how this letter from Tupac to Madonna ended up in Darlene's possession, but now Darlene is trying to auction it off. Okay.
So this story gets saucier and juicier the more you dig into it.
Okay.
So firstly, there's been a letter that Tupac wrote just to someone randomly while he was in prison.
Yeah.
That sold for $150,000 a few years ago. I don't know who has that money and what relevance it is to you, but, you know, that's a lot of money. Now, imagine this letter from Tupac to Madonna, how much that would rake up. Mm. But here's another thing that's in this letter, and, like, this will make it even juicier. It's the fact that Tupac wrote to Madonna, basically, one of the reasons why they have to break up is because dating a white woman was not good for his image, he says.
Yeah.
So he
especially
says,
in prison.
No, like, he generally says in the letter, you know, for you, Madonna, it's like kind of cool, or, you know,
it
your
makes
fans
you look
won't
edgy.
Mind it. Yeah.
Sure.
But for my fans, it doesn't exactly work. So deuces, I have to call this off. Now that's why people want to have their hands on it. So
I
don't know.
It might have to do with the fact that, like, she's being broken up with, because my understanding, and I'm just going to completely stereotype you and assume that you can give me lots of background on this, is that Madonna is like a total ball buster. Like, who's mm-hmm. she dated? She's dated Vanilla Ice and Tupac, so she's right. done the full mm-hmm. spectrum of the hip hop world. She's had Guy Ritchie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sean Penn before.
Sean Penn,
yeah. And her preference of late is she likes some very young models. So she, currently, you know, she's going through models in their 20s phase. That's what she's...
And again, I got to say, why the hell not?
Yeah. No, I mean, we're just saying, like,
she's
this
so,
is...
Yeah, she's so totally earned the right to...
Sure. I mean, I'm not judging the fact that she wants to goon, like, young, hot guys. Mm-hmm. It's more about how many famous dudes and who has she chewed up and spat out.
I got to refer to something I saw in the news last night. Karen Morn from ENCA is, like, the worst... nightmare of Batabile Dlamini. I don't know if you've seen it.
No,
do you remember at that press conference she was asking her questions and Batabile was like, I'm not answering that, I'm not answering this. Well, I saw a clip last night. I wish I could have pulled this because it was on TV live and I wasn't recording. And she's coming down to some press briefing or something and Karen Morn's asking her about Sasa and this huge saga there because, you know, Magwaza, the guy who was the director general, has been fired, or he's testifying against her in order to clear up his role in the whole saga. And she just will not answer any questions. She's wearing a big pair of Versace sunglasses and a baseball cap. I mean, this is a minister. She looks like she's trying to be a rapper. And she walks past and she just ignores any questions asked of her. This is her job. And then they show a clip of her at this press conference, like dancing to some music in front of a banner and some band who are playing, but she's absolutely not prepared to address the single biggest cock-up of her department and of her individual responsibility to the state. She's not talking about what she's there to do. She's dancing in front of a crowd and dressing like a celebrity and ignoring journalists. This woman has contempt for the people of South Africa, particularly the poor people of South Africa, who are under her aegis when she is the one who disburses their welfare checks to them. It's absolutely disgraceful. It's unacceptable in every way, and it just seems that she has no feelings of responsibility whatsoever.
Queen nothing, as it were.
Queen nothing.
Yeah, I mean, she was wearing a cap and shades. You know,
oh, you've got the clip?
Anyone who's wearing a pair of shades inside a room immediately irritates me.
Oh, my God.
Immediately irritates me. Like,
no, I know. I feel you. Like, politics aside, that's just an act of douchebaggery.
It's just unbelievable.
It's a question of what are you hiding behind your glasses? What are you hiding?
I've got to say, like, I'm so happy that Karen Morn is chasing her down over this thing, because it seems to me that no one is giving her the hard, tough ride that she deserves, this Batabile Dlamini. Where did you find that clip, Sian? Let me look
it's for it. Actually on Twitter. Just searched for Batabile Dlamini, and it's interesting to now find out that this is part of her 67 minutes. She was meant to be distributing sanitary pads to young women, which she was an hour late for. And then as she entered, she was like, actually, you journalists are harassing me. So,
But something I can never work out about politicians, right? In my experience of being offense, these blue light brigades, they're always in a hurry, right? Always. So why are these people always late?
Yeah, they're always. Particularly the worst ministers are the ones who are always late. Look, there's some people who are always late because they just have no sense of responsibility. Here it is. Listen to this quickly. This is obviously from the news on SABC. This is the news reporter, the anchor woman, and they cross now. That was all she had to say. Please stop harassing me. It's not the clearest clip in the world, but that. So she was there. She was there. You're telling me that she did this whole thing as part of her Mandela Day contribution?
Hey, like, what I don't understand is how do these people think that? How do they not have any accountability? So screw up, okay? So you want to, you know, be corrupt. You are consciously doing that, and you think there won't be any repercussions to this? How do you expect that everyone will just be like, oh, it's cool. No, you aren't doing your job. Oh, no, you've made people angry. Oh, no, you've taken money. Oh, no, you've disappointed. How do they not feel any sense of accountability?
So what's happened in the last couple of days is the minister, Batabile Dlamini, fired the SASSA CEO, Thokozani Magwaza, and that made news headlines. And right. So understandably so, because this happened literally in the last day or two, understandably so, at a public event, the journalists who are there are going to try and ask the minister questions about, you know, her firing of the CEO.
SASSA directly affects 17 million people's livelihood. Their only income. That's a large slice of our population. It's clearly 1/5 to 2/5 of South Africa's total population that are dependent on this one woman, and particularly the CEO of that institution which is there to pay them. So it's perfectly reasonable for you to ask her questions about her job.
And they're vulnerable. Portion of the population.
But also, journalists have in the past reported on alleged clashes between Batabile Dlamini and the then CEO because they were in dispute about the whole payments scandal. So the fact that she has now fired this person raises a lot of questions, because it kind of looks like, oh, so you got rid of the person that was, you know, publicly like trying to get in your way, in the sense of, you know, him saying that they disagree with the way that you're doing things. So that is why the journalists are also interested in the story, is because the dismissal of the CEO looks very fishy.
I just love this clip. This is still my favorite, of Karen Morn at that press conference with Batabile. Listen to this.
What are you going to do? Are you going to go to the Constitutional Court?
It's our responsibility to recommend for the division, and it remains our responsibility through the CEO to sign off that deviation.
But has the CEO signed that off?
I manje, you want to get into our offices. We have highlighted that it remains our responsibility.
But But ma'am, where is the CEO? Because this is a SASA briefing and
but,
he's not here.
But how should we account about people that are on sick leave? You are really ill-treating us.
How?
Yes, but your spokesperson told the Sunday Times that he was being suspended because he'd spoken to the post office.
Which spokesperson?
Lumka.
No, that's not true.
Well,
I know it's not
Sunday
true.
The Sunday Times said it's true, so I mean...
No, it's the, if they want to say so, they must say so.
So there's no problem in your relationship with him whatsoever?
What relationship are you talking about?
Well, your working relationship, because
what's
according
the
to the report, you were unhappy the fact that he was negotiating with post office.
We've told you our position. In as far as the post office
minister, with all due respect, you are constitutionally mandated to
come here with your preconceived ideas. If I did not stand up, you were going to say I'm a lame duck. Now that I've stood up because things were not moving, I'm now clouting the constitution.
But you're not answering any of the questions. Your DG has resigned. He's the accounting officer, and you won't speak about that. That is not acceptable in a constitutional democracy. We have a free press. We get to ask questions. We get to do that. That's our job. And your job is to provide us with satisfactory answers and assure the people of South Africa that you're actually in control of this crisis. And I don't think anyone is thinking that at this point.
No, it's you who's not thinking that way. We have
just
said we're going to pay on the 1st of April.
But we have no idea at what cost.
Obviously, this was all nonsense. I mean, the only thing that she did say that was true is they did pay because they knew there would have been unbelievable pandemonium if they hadn't. But I just love the way that she refuses to answer a question. She somehow believes, and it's because the president's given her the impression that all she has to do is do what he says and everything will be fine. She's got protectio. And she's just not interested in working for the people of South Africa.
She was also very defensive, from what I could tell, from the word go in responding to those questions.
I mean, it's major.
It's the media that has been perpetrating that we are not going to pay on the 1st of April.
We have never said
and
that. We have raised questions about the legality of the CPS deal in light of the constitutional court order.
Or wait up until the 31st of March and the 1st of July. You have created a lot of tension throughout the country. It's our grandmothers and grandfathers that walk long distances.
Ma'am, it's
distances.
Exactly because of that we're here today to ask you questions.
It is
Treasury has said it is a self-created crisis that
you
created.
Them. I'm
your
not
department.
Going to speak on behalf of the Treasury. They must speak for themselves. I'm not going to answer what they think is the problem. It's their issue. Ours is to ensure that on the 1st of April, our beneficiaries...
Well, this is what you get when you put someone in a position that is completely incompetent. Full stop. This is the great place to which CADA deployment brings us. Let her be the shining example of what that process leads us to. And if anybody feels that there's still a good argument to be made for CADA deployment, all I will say to you is, Batabile Dlamini. End of argument.
And that's more than enough said in
I
that
reckon.
Argument.
My God. And then I saw this clip yesterday in the news, and I thought, is this old footage? But it turns out it's new. Karen Morn is not giving up with this woman. You know how she was always there for the Oscar Pistorius trial?
Yes.
Day and night.
Yes.
Early morning. She was around, man.
Yeah,
this woman
she's
works.
Cool.
Yeah, she's working
hard.
She does
work.
Should get her back in here sometime. Talk to her about Batabile Dlamini. I reckon there's stuff that she doesn't even put on online that we should know about. But I believe Dlamini hates her. You can just see it. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk to Mark Francis about an extraordinary story, a very harrowing and difficult story to talk about, but it's stuff that goes on in South Africa all the time. Mark was 5 years old when he was sexually abused by a neighbor. He was sexually abused later on again. He has had a very, very tough journey, and I think it's worth discussing because a lot of people try to brush this stuff under the carpet. A lot of people feel that if something's uncomfortable, that we shouldn't talk about it at all, and we're going to. And I think it's going to be an interesting discussion for some people who can, first of all, empathize with him, and second of all, people who are going through maybe similar things. So we're going to get him in here. He says, you don't have to feel alone. And we'll talk to him about his journey and his story in the next couple of minutes. CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning, ready to look after you and keep you company through the course of today. Right. This is what I wanted to be. DJ Khaled with Chance the Rapper, Lil Wayne, Quavo, and Bieber. Grab a seat, Mark. Mark Francis is with us. He's got a hell of a story to tell. He actually contacted CNI via email. Was it email? How did you get hold of us?
Yeah, it was email.
Yeah, email. Right. Make yourself comfortable, man. How are you?
I'm very comfortable. How are you guys?
Yeah, good. Listen, you've got one hell of a story.
It is, eh?
Yeah. Jeez, dude. I just read the little bit that you told me in the email. I thought, wow. A lot of people say that they've got things to tell and... you know, got life experience to share, and wow, I don't think many of us have the kind of story that you do. It's Wednesday, cliffcentral.com, just to clear that up, because I did say Tuesday earlier. It's definitely Wednesday. Mubs has checked her sources. She's got independent corroboration. It's definitely Wednesday.
And you know, until I say so, then it's just not true.
You are the credibility.
Say it, sister, say it.
So, Mark Francis, you put up a Facebook share about the importance of having tough conversations, mm-hmm. right?
That's right.
So, your life, and I don't mean to be flippant about it, but can you summarize your story in a paragraph for us so that people can understand the kind of road you've walked?
Yeah, I think that it's about... I think if anything, my life's been about courage and having the courage to understand what I was going through.
What happened to you?
I was sexually abused when I was 5 years old by a family member. Well, by at that time, someone that considered to be a friend of the family. Mm-hmm. Right? So it was the neighbor, right? By a man. And at the same time, my parents went through a divorce.
Yeah.
And obviously they missed the signs of what was going on with me.
They were too busy each other to pay attention to
you. You can imagine, it's an emotional thing, right?
Right.
And so we moved with my mom to her family.
Uh-huh.
And there, unfortunately, I was sexually abused again. So that continued. And I mean, I'm sitting here, I'm going through all of that at the moment. So just bear with me. And anyway, so that was it. And then we finally moved away from there. And our life continued. And the rest, as you can read in the story, which you can share with everybody online, and it's on Facebook anyway, it was just a journey of I'm looking for an outlet for people to notice me and talk to me and understand what it is that's going on with me. How do I express myself?
Because no one sat you down and said, hey, nothing wrong with you. This is not your fault.
No, because they didn't know.
Yeah, they didn't know.
They didn't know. And how was I at 6, 7 years old to tell them what was going on with me?
What kind of... what is the experience like? This is something people are very uncomfortable about talking about. When you're a kid like that and some adult comes into your life, gains your trust, takes advantage of you, what kind of thoughts and feelings are you going through when that happens?
Yeah, I can, it's a state of confusion. It's your head is like wanting... You know, if you have a migraine, right, it wants to explode. Because you know what's happening to you is wrong.
Yeah.
But then you're also being led by somebody that you kind of sort of trust.
Yeah.
And you know what's going to happen. So you're approaching in my case, it was a toilet in a caravan. And it's confusing and it hurts. Your brain just, you know, wants to explode. And then you just want it to be over. You know, so eventually you just go through the process.
You physically suffer through it because you just want to finish and get out of there.
I think it's an emotional suffering rather than just the physical. There is a physical element to it, but it's really a psychological thing. And you understand even at that young age that you're going to get hurt, right? in whichever way, right? And in my case, it was the sexual abuse, but that leads to other things, you know?
Yeah.
And at a young age, I'm thinking, God, I just want to get it over with, you know, so that I can get out of here and be free.
And do you think other kids are also suffering like this, or
hell
it's
yes.
just me?
No, it's not me. This is something, my story, unfortunately, is not unique to South Africa.
Yeah, but when you're going through it, do you think, why is this happening to me?
Of course, yes. Of course, it's why me? Why me? And then I'm looking at people around me and I'm saying, how can you not see that I'm hurting and I need your help? How can you not see?
And these are adults.
These are adults. How do you not see?
Do they do they not see what they're doing? Do they, are they incapable of, like, I've heard that people who take sexual advantage of kids, that it's a disease, that it's a mental illness on their part, that they need treatment rather than just to be killed.
I can resonate with that and I can understand that to a certain degree. If you read my story for Paul and Ella, have you read that?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so I sent it to you guys. But okay, let's break it down. I have a mental illness as a result of this sexual abuse, right?
And what's your mental?
I have bipolar disorder, right? And it's emanated from this abuse. Mm-hmm. And there's two different types of thought. The one thought on the medical front is that, yes, you're born with it. Somebody in your family has it.
Mm.
And there's another part that says, listen, you went through something traumatic. And this is what I believe, because I've achieved some amazing things in my life. And these medical professionals can't explain it. Mm. Why? Oh, Mark, you had good coping mechanisms.
Mm.
And I say to them, but that doesn't make any sense to me, because what are you? I don't understand all of this. So my outlet was sport. My outlet was sport. There I was free.
Yeah.
I was able to do whatever I wanted to do, and I was able to achieve things. But the biggest thing that I achieved was that people noticed me.
Mm.
And they were like, oh my God, Mark, you can do this. And then they were touching me, and they were holding me, and they were embracing me. And that made me feel better about the situation that I found myself in. Because that's what sport was. But I could have done something totally different. It could have been English, it could have been drama, yeah. It could have been math.
You never know. Huh?
I never know. How would I know?
Mark, what do you say to your mom? I mean, like, when do you break it to her that this stuff has happened to you? How old are you when she finds out?
She doesn't know yet.
She still doesn't know?
No.
And you still haven't brought it up with her?
No, because I don't know where she is. So
explain.
So I'll explain. So in the story, you see my father now at 63 years old, and he's dying of cancer, so he's in a hospice, and I've brought it up with him.
Mm.
And you can see the emotional trauma on somebody. When you speak to them, when I spoke to my dad, and I spoke to him in front of his sister, who lives in Canada, and she came over, because you can imagine they're making arrangements for...
Sure, he's dying.
He's dying, yeah. And I have to be sympathetic to that.
Sure.
And when I broke the story to him, oh my gosh, you should have seen his face. And that's when I knew for the first time, oh, hang on a second, he didn't know, and what he and my mother were going through was as equally traumatic and emotional for him, considering what I was going through. So I can understand why they missed
it. And then he must now be filled with guilt over that, because at the time you would have thought, he must know about this, maybe he just thinks it's okay.
Garrett, when you read Paul and Ella later, and maybe we'll have to have another conversation around that, which I'll be happy to, he does feel guilty. Who wouldn't feel guilty? Anybody would. But I don't blame him. I've forgiven him, because I said to him, look, you don't know. You didn't know.
Yeah.
But then through that, we had another tough conversation. He told me about his life. He told me about his childhood. He shared with me his journey. And then everything
came. Was it similar?
Not from a sexual abuse perspective, but he went through a journey.
Yeah.
He went through a journey. Would you like me to touch on it?
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of this is repeating cycle after cycle. So people get trapped in this stuff. And if you know his story, then it maybe informs yours.
Okay, so let me give some context then. So this is, very quickly, my father was born Muslim, right? To a Muslim mother and father. But that marriage separated at birth.
Uh-huh.
So he went and he got his mother remarried. And what happened was he was brought up Christian.
Uh-huh.
So his whole life, he never knew that he was Muslim. Right, and on his 21st birthday, that Muslim family came to congratulate him and wish him happy birthday.
And then he was like, who the hell are you people?
Who are you?
Yeah.
And that changed the course of his life. True story. My father wanted to become a priest. He was going to study Christian theology right, at 21, because that's how much he loved it.
Uh-huh.
And then can you imagine these Muslim people coming in and saying, listen, you are Muslim.
Yeah. Well, you were born into a Muslim family. Yeah.
Well, he was born Muslim. And then anyway, that changed his life.
I aver that no one is born religious at all.
Yeah, yeah.
My understanding is that everybody's born with complete innocence and happiness, and then the religious nuts come in and fuck it up.
And find... And I actually agree with that. Right? But that was my father's journey, and it changed his life. And I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to tell him what about my life. And I told him about my life. And I'm looking for something from him, and then he gives me this to process. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, as much as I'm sitting here trying to tell you this so that you can die peacefully and you can have peace and that I forgive you, he puts all of this on me. And I, as an individual, because I consider myself to be a mature individual and logical, I have to sit there and I have to process like I am now, keep the emotions in check and say, okay, now I understand.
Do you think he told you that stuff so that he could make you feel that he empathizes with you and he understands what you've gone through? Or do you think he's telling you that stuff because he's, again, making this your burden?
No, it's exactly that. He, for the first time in his life, with his elder son, realized that now we are both in a unique position to have what we are doing here in having a tough conversation.
Why do people in families where this sort of thing has happened, why do so few of those families end up discussing it, talking about it, finding a way to deal with it, helping each other? Is it because there's guilt, there's huge guilt? Is that what the biggest problem is?
No, I think what it comes down to, and that's why I touched in the story about, I don't like, look, I'm very liberal on race and stuff like that. It's the way we've been conformed, I think. You know, it's a sense of embarrassment. What is the neighbor going to say? What is this person going to say? What is this person of status going to say? And that's very typical of what happened with my mother and how she reacted, you know. And
so how long has she been out of your life?
I'll give you the story. So I actually honor my mother and my father in the piece that I've written, right? And what I talk about is that I had the understanding that what happened with them, that divorce, was so painful that I can understand why she didn't pay attention to me. And then the doctors and the teachers are saying there's something wrong with this kid. And that's how they said it. I wasn't there. If the doctor said there's something wrong with your child, he's mentally ill, he's never going to do this, he's never going to achieve these things, he's not going to be nothing. And she listened to them and she believed it. But now she has to look after me, you know. So that was her way of dealing with the situation. Obviously, she dealt with it in the wrong way. But that's
how
it
did
is.
She deal with it?
The abuse and the verbal abuse and the hitting. I mean, it was really brutal. But you know, I kind of understood. I just understood. I don't know why. I just understood. And that's why I say there must be some sort of divine intervention with me. It's beyond my understanding, right? But maybe that's that human nature of survival. You know, if you jump in the water.
Also, like, maybe she just didn't have the tools to deal with this problem. You know, she had no way of making sense of it.
Of course. And also, her family didn't offer any support, you know. So what do you do to that?
Does she do? Were you alone?
As in?
I mean, like, after, you know, when you would get home, I mean, your mother was around, but she didn't really give a damn.
So my mom would be at work and she would come home at 5, and then this would be the whole process.
There'd be
the frustration,
and
the verbal
and
abuse, whatever.
But I mean, you must have felt like there was no one in the world you could rely on.
I still feel that way.
And every adult you'd ever depended on would either have abused you or not given a damn.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. And you see, I brought some people with me today. And I actually brought a classmate that was with me.
You brought like an entourage.
I have an entourage, and that is a story.
Like 50 people here.
That story is going to blow your mind, right? When I tell you that story, you're going to see how all of this comes into perspective. But I've got a classmate over here, Bayo, she's just sitting out there. She was with me from standard 4 right up until the matric. And she knew none of this. She knew absolutely none of this. And she will tell you a very interesting perspective of what she interpreted me or perceived me to be in school. You know.
Well, let's call
her up.
Let's
bring her in.
Yeah. No, just get up to this microphone. Pull this microphone up.
Yeah.
Come on, talk to me. You don't have to be shy. All right. Hey, Baya, how's it?
Hey, guys.
What's
how
up?
Are you?
Yeah, good.
Thank you. I'm good.
So what was he like as a standard 4? What was that?
Standard 6, sorry. Standard 6.
How old are you then? You're like, what?
16.
Okay, 16.
Well, I was actually in school with him, from standard 6. I met him in standard 6, and we were in the same class right through until matric. And he was, I would have never guessed that this was going on in his life. He was very studious. He was a gentleman. many people would tell you that he was extremely sporty.
Yeah.
We played volleyball together. He was very good. I sucked. but yeah, I would have never.
When did you eventually find out? Did he tell you?
No. I only eventually found out when we were reconnected about 2 years ago.
And then he told you? Or did you read his story?
I didn't know the extent of it then, even, until I read his story.
Yeah.
About a month ago.
And did it bring you guys closer?
I think it has.
What was it that you think made you empathize with him? What was it that made you suddenly need to be closer to him? Or was it you who drew closer to her?
Yeah, I was always close to Bayer, you know, but in a different way. And I think, like, sharing the story, I kind of knew that if I shared the story, it would give all of them context of the interaction and the connections. And it's just brought, it's amazing. You can imagine the journey we are now, you know, the way I interact with her. But we were oblivious in school. We just sat next to each other and we never spoke. And now she has understanding to who I am and what I dealt with.
Yeah. How much do you feel you can ask and how much do you feel you can talk about now? Now that it's all kind of out there.
I think we talk about almost all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm pretty open that way. And so is Mark. So.
Do you sometimes feel, though, that you have to be careful not to be patronizing, to go, oh, I feel sorry for you? Because that's not what he needs, right?
I do.
A reminder of that.
I do. I feel like, yeah, that is necessary. A bit of... not tough love, but not, like you say,
you're treating him like an equal. You want him to know that it's not, oh, shame, I'm here as a social worker. You definitely, that's not the relationship.
Yeah.
But Mark, how does this affect you? I mean, with your relationships going into your adult life, how did it affect the way that you felt about other people, that you felt you could be open and honest with other people? I mean, was there a big wall between you and everybody else? For at least a long part of your life so far.
Yeah, if I have to summarize it up, it's been a lonely life, even if I allow somebody in. Because you allow them to a certain point, and then you can't really talk much, or you're scared to talk about it because you don't understand how they're going to react, you know. And I've been in situations where I've been open about it, and then these people, you never hear from them again. And they just close the chapter. And these are even people that say they loved me and that they were there for me and that I sacrificed so much for, you know. But then also at the same time, you allow somebody in and I'll talk from my relationships, from a sexual perspective, it affected it.
Sure.
Intimacy scares me. It really does scare me.
And sex must be very, very emotional for you because you feel that vulnerability that you felt when you were a kid.
And it's extremely confusing. And I can say, like, without going into too much detail, which I haven't shared, my sexual history is confusing, you know. And
what do you mean by that?
So
do you just have conflicted feelings every time you're intimate with somebody?
Well, for me, sex with a man is something that's hurting me.
Mm.
And I feel, and because you go through these emotions, and specifically with the bipolar, right, you would be drawn to that. You would be drawn to environments.
So the pain magnetizes you.
Yeah, so it's like, I want to hurt myself now because I think that's making me feel better. Mm. So I would be drawn to that. And you have to understand that. You have to understand it and go and work with professionals, say, what is going on with me now?
Mm-hmm.
What is going on with me? And I have to put all of this work in. And people around me don't understand that. So they just think, oh, well, Mark is introverted, or Mark is this, or Mark is that. Because we judge, right? Don't we judge?
Everybody wait to put labels on people, because it then allows us to put them in a box and we can put them
And
away.
I've had labels my whole life. And so what I do is I allow people to a certain point, and then I put this wall up. And it's natural. It's not me being arrogant, as people call me. They say I'm arrogant, I'm this.
And with women?
Yeah, with women, it's... phew, I mean... I don't struggle to get the attention of women, not because I'm a Brad Pitt lookalike or a Garrett look, you know.
Trust me, there's no Brad Pitt lookalike in this room.
Yeah.
See us, See, is pretty attractive. Admit it. I mean, he's very good looking.
And if you don't agree with you, he'll tell you that he is.
I don't need you to.
And Mabali, you know, she's
of course everybody. But yeah. I think for me, this is what it is. Beauty comes from within, and I've always believed that. So I love the fact that you will open the site up and allow me in, and that is what I find beautiful about men and about women. Right. And so if you allow me in and if you allow me to do that and get to know you, I don't care how you look. Yeah. But if you allow me to do that, that is what attracts me. So I pay attention to women.
Have you had successful relationships?
Yes, yes.
With men and women?
No, not with men and women. I'm not gay. I'm not bisexual.
No, I'm saying. So you've had successful relationships with women so far?
Yes, I was married to one.
What's the longest you've been together with somebody?
10 years. Right. I was married to my ex for 10 years.
And how come that didn't continue?
That is how this type of things affect everything in your life.
But I know people who weren't abused whose relationships last a year. So you just shouldn't beat yourself up about that.
No, it's not that I'm coming across as beating myself up. She reacted to a situation that she did not understand.
What was that?
Me. Because obviously my behavior, etc. Like, I'll give you an example. There can be days where I will sit where I'm sitting right now, thinking about everything, playing everything over and over in my mind.
Yeah.
And I would be oblivious to what's happening around me. You could be talking to me. I'll be listening to you. I have a very good memory. I'll remember everything you said, but I will not acknowledge that you are there because I'm in this little space now, thinking about it. Yeah. And I'm dying inside. I'm saying, help me. Right? You're sitting right there. Just take your hand and help me. Just put it on me and that will work. That will work. That will change everything. But you don't understand what I'm going through because I'm just sitting there and I'm ignoring you. Now you're getting upset. You're getting pissed off.
Yeah, okay. I see what you mean.
You know, and then what you do, then because
it's like you're in a bubble.
Yeah. And then they say, oh, you passive aggressive, you know, or you this, or you that, whatever label, whatever it is. And obviously that affects a relationship. And that's what happened to me. So you can imagine how difficult that was for me. This is a woman that I love, still love today. And she loves me, but she doesn't understand me. And I can't explain to her what's going on. And it's affecting our relationship. And I can see that. And then she leaves me based on what she does not understand.
Right.
And I have to let her go. I have to let her go.
Have you had like lots of professional help trying to deal with this stuff? Because that, for a lot of people, is difficult to ask for help. And then when they get it, they sometimes aren't consistent about it.
Yeah, I asked a lot of people for help. And it got to the point where it's just simple. Take this tablet and take that tablet and go and see somebody. And I said to myself, that doesn't help the situation. That doesn't make me forget. You have to, it's a collective effort. I've got to sit around people that understand what is going on with me. And they have to then make a sacrifice. They have to make a sacrifice. To be part of my life is a sacrifice. And unfortunately,
but
people
doesn't
won't
that sometimes,
do it.
Don't you sometimes get to a place, though, where you're a bit narcissistic, where it's all about you? Because for these people, they might really care about you, but eventually it's just too much hard work. I mean, you know, some people don't have the time or the inclination to sort out other people's problems.
Exactly. So that's why it's been a very lonely life for me. So I understand that and I let them go. And then I do what I have to do.
Sure. But for those people who do put in the time and the effort, I mean, you care about
them. That's the one sitting out here.
Right.
And then that's the thing. When you have people like these people sitting over here who equally have gone through their own journeys,
right,
but are connected through one story in ways that will blow your mind, but are passionate about changing other people's lives.
Now, this is the thing I wanted to ask you about, because more than anything else, this is maybe where you can be helpful to everybody, is what would you advise if there's someone listening now who's going through what you've been through and the stuff that you continue to go through in your life? What's the breakthrough? What's the key? Is it the people you mix with? Is it the way that you deal with those moments where you're in a bubble and you can't talk to anybody and you feel like you're ignoring them or they're not breaking through, they don't care about you? What's the moment that you realized you're not alone? That's what you said at the end of that article, you're not alone.
Yeah.
So how do you know? Because some people feel alone.
Well, what I meant over there is that you don't have to be alone. You know, you are not alone, and you are not alone. I've had, if anything I can teach people, my story and the share is the process of letting it go and let people know. That's what it is. So just all you have to do, it comes from within you, Gareth. There is something in all of us. There's something inside there. I can't explain it. It's beyond my understanding. But it's there. And it's like when I tried to commit suicide, everything tells me I don't want to live. I want to jump off this building. I want to jump in front of the truck. But there's something inside me that says, no, you're better than that. You're a beautiful individual. You're passionate. You are worth something. So you don't really need other people to tell you that, but you got to believe in it. Believe in yourself, and you will find somebody that's going to open their hand or their heart, just like these people over here. So that's difficult.
Well,
to
explain. Wow, you're an impressive bunch of people. I mean, it is a sacrifice, like he said. Yeah. It must be difficult some of the time, huh? Well, thanks for coming to share your story with us. We've only really scratched the surface of this. Yeah. And if people want to know more and they want to contact you, they want to follow you, are there ways that we can get in contact?
Yeah, so we're doing some great stuff with Volvo Truck South Africa. Mm-hmm. And this whole company that we've started now, that's going to be about empowering and inspiring youth and people. And we're going to be touching on sexuality and all of these type of things. But I want to say a message to everybody out mm-hmm. there. Have 20 seconds of courage to want to understand what somebody else is going through. Right? Just have that little bit of courage. It will scare right. you, but just have that courage and just say hello. Just say hello to that individual. Everything you're saying, don't talk to them. Oh, he's damaged, she's damaged. Just say hello, you know. And if you're out there and you're dealing with what I'm dealing with, I promise you right now on Garrett Cliff, right, on Cliff Central, get hold of me. I will give you my contact
How
details.
Do we do that?
Facebook, I don't know if we want to set up something. I'll chat to the guys at Volvo how we do this, mm-hmm. you know. And because I don't really have...
Well, what's the easiest way? Because, you know, if we give away like 3 or 4 different ways of getting hold of you, people will forget all of them.
I think Facebook is the best way, right?
All right, Facebook. Yeah, and Facebook's the how best do we way. Look you up? Mark Francis?
I've got 2 now. So it's Mark Francis and Mujahid Mika Francis. I don't know how to link the accounts together.
Those are both your names.
Those are both my names and my Muslim name.
Hey, right? You're bipolar. You're allowed to.
I'm allowed to. And I've got a certificate to prove that.
All right.
So... So, you know, just connect with me, and I promise you, I don't believe that I can change your life, but I will come and I will sit down with you and we will have a conversation. That is what I promise. I will find the time and we will have a conversation, whether it's via Facebook or whatever.
All right. I love it, dude. Keep doing the good work, eh?
Yep.
Because I thought that your story was moving. I thought there are probably a lot of people who could benefit from hearing
it. I don't think that you have to thank me, Garrett. I think you have to thank you and your team over here because you are helping me to deliver this message. So thank you, guys.
Well, keep doing the good work. All right, bro. Very nice to see you. There we go, everybody. Mark Francis, what a story. In a moment or two, we will meet a professor who was born in a Limpopo village, and we'll find out about the extraordinary story of how he's become a master of artificial intelligence. But I thought this is probably the most appropriate song we could play, right, Sia? You know what I'm going to play now.
I knew it.
That is what Mark says.
I actually was thinking about it at the and back of my head as we were right. speaking to him.
Another day has gone. I'm still all alone.
This is CliffCentral.com.